Good morning, everyone. I'm going to introduce you to our panel today on orthodoxy and feminism. On the end here, Dr. Yoel Finkelman, who in addition to teaching at Midrashet Lindenbaum is the director of projects and research at Atid, which is a Jerusalem foundation that works to develop educational leadership. He has his doctorate from the Department of Jewish Thought at the Hebrew University, has published in numerous Jewish journals, and lives with his family in Beit Shemesh. To my immediate right, Dr. Tamar Ross, who we were with in the last session, teaches, taught for a long time in the Department of Jewish Philosophy at Bar-Ilan, and still teaches at Midrashet Lindenbaum, is a world-renowned expert on the work of Rav Kook, and of course is known for her seminal work in the area of women in Judaism, and specifically in 2004, published the widely hailed book, Expanding the Palace of Torah, Orthodoxy and Feminism, which has now actually been translated into Hebrew and been published. Dr. Ross and her husband Yaakov, who's also Professor Emeritus of Philosophy, have 7 children, and they live in Yerushalayim. Next to me, Rav Yehuda Gilad, who is the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Maale Gilboa, and since 1983 has served as the Rabbi of Kibbutz Lavi. In addition to fulfilling the many facets of this role within the Lavi community, he offers his services to all neighboring settlements, and as well as a national spokesman for the morally sensitive in the religious community, has earned recognition for his views and his grassroots activism in promoting a Jewish and democratic state. In June 2002, Rav Gilad became a Haver Knesset, where he served on the Education and Labor and Welfare Committees, and he's also an architect and campaigner for the Kinneret Declaration. Last night, we introduced you to Rabbi Benny Lau, who's on the end. Here's the director of the Center for Judaism and Society, as well as the Institute for Social Justice at Beit Morashah in Yerushalayim. He serves as the rabbi of the Ramban Synagogue in the Katamon neighborhood of Yerushalayim. He lectures on halakha and social justice at Beit Morashah's Robert M. Barron College and Bar-Ilan University, which is where he received his MA and his PhD. We wanted to bring everyone together this morning to discuss what in many ways may be the most crucial issue in halakhic Judaism today. I want to begin with a quotation that Dr. Roth mentions in her book from the late philosopher Yeshaya Leibowitz. Professor Leibowitz in 1982 stated that, quote, "the question of women in Judaism is more crucial than all of the political problems of the people and its state. Failure to deal seriously with it threatens the viability of the Judaism of Torah and mitzvot in the contemporary world." I'd like to ask each of you if you believe that Professor Leibowitz's contention is correct, and if so, why? We'll begin with you, Dr. Ross.
I agree with Professor Leibowitz, but not for the reasons that he intended. Leibowitz meant to understand the problem as a halachic one. That is, that in the sense of halachic readiness, the religious world was caught unprepared for the phenomenon of women in the modern world, to which, in all the usual categories of halachic categories of understanding the role and nature of women, do not apply. It may be true that even in this sense, feminism offers a unique challenge because it relates numerically to a group that consists of at least 50% of the Jewish population and which has traditionally been excluded from the interpretive and decision-making process of halakha and whose legal status was always mediated by men. But if we leave aside these considerations, this issue is arguably on a par with many of the other problems arising out of a halachic system that doesn't possess categories in order to effectively relate to the modern condition. I don't mean technological problems. Here, the halakha really has advanced. But on another level, feminism is unique because it touches upon more profound theological issues upon which the very authority of halakha appears to be based. That is the challenge that feminist readings of the Torah and their understanding of its male bias pose to prevailing orthodox conceptions of Torah min haShamayim. On this theological level, feminist difficulties begin with the distressing discovery of the profound normative character of maleness in the Torah and in Jewish tradition at large. The Torah addresses the male as the representative Jew and perceives women as other in relation to men. In the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, the role and value of women is defined and limited even further by male interests and considerations. Women aren't the intended audience, and women's religious experiences and self-understanding don't figure as a central topic worthy of discussion and are generally passed over in silence. But the feminist critique doesn't stop here. After noting that Jewish religious practice is based on exclusion of women from the public or communal arena, women begin to realize that if the Torah is a book that places men at the center, the world that the Torah constructs in order to make sense of Jewish experience is also a world viewed from a male perspective and bears a more implicit male bias, which is so subtle that the innocent reader usually remains unaware of its existence. At this stage, feminists urge us to consider, for example, to what extent God is portrayed in the image of human male in the opening chapters of Bereshit with its creation story. But even more profoundly, the deeper question that feminism raises on this level is, can a document that depicts God, the world, and history through a blatantly male perspective be attributed to a spiritual source that by definition should be beyond time and culture-bound conditioning? At this point, feminism clearly poses a problem that should rivet the attention of every traditional Jew who sees the notion of verbal revelation as the basis upon which the entire authority of historic Judaism rests.
Does this work?
Yep. Yeah. I imagine that in part I'm here on this panel because of written critiques that I've written of Professor Ross's position, and I suppose that kind of puts me in the position here of being a little bit on the traditionalist side, a little bit on the right critiquing the left, and it is not precisely a position that I desire to be in, and that relates to a disagreement that I have with Professor Ross, not about the substance of her position, but about the way in which she presents the role of feminism in her description. To start off, I think that Professor Leibovitz is both obviously correct and entirely wrong. Obviously correct in the sense that there's no doubt that any modern Jewish approach has to deal with women. But the range of options that is available with how to deal with women is enormous. And if Professor Leibovitz is hinting or stating explicitly elsewhere that what he thinks is more equality, more even-handedness, more opportunities, then it is clear to me that there are many communities of profoundly dedicated, profoundly religious Jews who are, on the one hand, dealing with the issue of women, and on the other hand, dealing with them in very different ways. Some of the most dedicated Jewish communities have dealt with the question of women by taking an anti-feminist position. Now, I'm not advocating that position. I'm just pointing it out as a fact. And that's, I think, part of the reason why Leibovitz is incorrect, if what he means is that Judaism is only viable if it adopts a more feminist position. I may not like the anti-feminist position that much of the Orthodox world has taken. In fact, I don't. It may not even satisfy many of the women who are in that community for precisely the reasons that Professor Ross has articulated and that Tamar El-Or has articulated in many of her intriguing and insightful books. But that's there, and it's an option. My commitment to a version of Orthodox feminism is not dependent exclusively on the question of whether it works, because at least for the moment, the anti-feminist movement within Orthodoxy is a great deal more successful in terms of raw numbers than the feminist. The second issue that I want to point out is that Professor Ross is trying to tie the question of feminism
to the broader conception of revelation and the way in which the texts of Torah are culturally and historically conditioned. And I think there might be reason to draw a greater piece of separation between those two sections. Not because you cannot fairly articulate it in the way that Professor Ross has done, but because you can articulate it differently. That is to say, my own dispute with you is less about the question of feminism and more about the question of a desire to take religious language more literally than you're prepared to, an opposition to your religious naturalism. And it seems to me that you could mount a critique that might be less existentially compelling to women and sympathetic men, in which you say you want to know how we know that the Torah's texts are culturally and historically conditioned, not gender. Use categories of industrialization versus agricultural societies. Use categories of communication. Use categories of metaphors. I was recently in England and walked past Buckingham Palace, which was a profoundly religious experience because it made me entirely clear the Queen was in residence at the moment and people were coming in to visit her. And for many of them, there was a real sense of Yirat HaRomamut. Of entering, and it was clear to me how totally foreign that is, and that the liturgy, which is full of language of malchut, and this in the particular question, the malka was, in terms of gender language, was a woman, and largely speaking, a powerless woman. But there was a sense of yirat haromamut. The cultural categories in which language of malchut don't directly have to do with gender; they have to do with other things, and you could mount a critique. You could make the same point, you could raise the same question that Professor Ross raises at the center of her theology, not necessarily from the perspective of gender, but from the perspective of other sociocultural categories.
I say that. I agree with you.
I wanted to ask you, Rav Gilad, how central you think the issue is, of because both you and Rabbi Lau are working in active communities, right? You're not necessarily just in the academy, but you're working in living, breathing, active, Orthodox, mixed communities. How central do you think the question of women in Judaism is now? And what do you see as should be its central goals?
Okay. Good morning. I think, first of all, we have to distinguish between the two levels. The level of, from the point of view of the philosophical level, if it should be one of the most important problems that we deal with, or what is the situation right now, practically? Because maybe I'll tell you a story. I'm Rav in Kibbutz Lavi for about almost 25 years. I started when I was 5 years old. And I must tell you that I, as a man, try to push this kind of issues within Keilat Lavi, that this is a Keilah of Kibbutz Adati, very modern Orthodox, very open-minded. And I must tell you, most of the people, including most of the women, are not interested. So it means, we're speaking about small things, about Simchat Torah, or dancing with Sefer Torah, or this kind of issues. Most of the women, not just most, it's hardly to find one that will, if they will ask, they will find that I'm much more open than them to this direction. Sometimes I think maybe I have to try to encourage it, but I'm not so sure. And I'm asking myself why, because theologically and philosophically, I tend to agree that this should be one of the most important things. And in this level, I think that I agree with many, many things that I've read in your book, in the book of Professor Tamar Roset. In my eyes, was one of the most important books that I have read in the last few years, I must tell you. Although I do not agree with everything, but I think the direction is very, very important. But practically, on ground, it doesn't seem that people are so interested by it. And the question is why. Maybe we'll deal with it afterwards, because I believe it is very important to deal with it just in order to not just to solve this specific problem, this is a very important issue, but even more than that, just to show that Torah is something that sensitive to the moral issues, and I think there is something very specifically about this changes between the time of the Torah and the Halakha and Torah Shebaal Peh and today, because here we are speaking not just about changes but about very issues that they have moral results, and therefore we cannot ignore it. And this is a way that we can understand many other issues when we find gap between our standards of morality and things in the Torah. And we'll speak about it later, but I think therefore it's so important because it's something very relevant. And therefore, when I'm standing in front of my students in the yeshiva, I try to push to deal with this kind of issues just in order that they will be sensitive to this issue and will see the Torah in the way that I believe that it is.
I want to add, first of all, one point that when we introduced the beginning of the panel, so three of us, you heard about our knowledge, about our PhD, or if they was about what. Tamar Roth, we heard she has a husband and she has children.
Not true.
And it's true. It's true. It's true.
I'm going to reread what I said. For many years, Tamar Roth taught in the Department of Jewish Philosophy at Bar Ilan University. No, that was the first thing I said.
Right, but when...
So, Zerach, it's just an issue of listening.
No, you said that, but you end with her husband, Yaakov, and few children.
Right. You know why I did that? Because
no.
That's what's written on the page here.
Okay.
If you put your biography on the page, I'll read it too.
It's not against you. I think that we need to listen carefully. We need to listen carefully how we identify ourselves. Because so let's start. Okay. Boker Tov. My wife named Noah. She's...
There you go.
She's the head. She's standing in the head in Nishmat, a special program called Yoatzot Halacha, Halachic Advisor. And I mention that first of all because I want to return back home, and then secondly, I want to say that she grew up in Kibbutz Sa'ad, the other side of the state, and she in those days. About 35 years ago, she learned in the Kibbutz Dati high school, Kibbutz Yavne, and it was the only place in Israel that girls learned Gemara. Why? Because they learned like the boys. It was the same programs, the same schedule, everything was the same. It wasn't with a flag of feminism. It was just the way of living. And when we met and she heard that it's an issue, if you are learning Gemara or not, she didn't understand in the beginning why it make any difference. And it was true that Kibbutz Dati in the 70s found themselves as in the front of the modern Orthodox in Israel. If you are talking about Kibbutz Lavi, the first... I don't know if it was a meeting or a conference, Kenneth Lavi it's called. Kenneth Lavi was the first time that the modern Orthodox in States and Israel meet together to discuss issues that need to move in the Orthodox world. Now, in 1975, if you will check the subjects, no one mentioned the women business. No one. It wasn't an issue. They spoke about secular studies. They spoke about many, many, many other issues, maybe about Yeshivot, I think. But they didn't mention the feminism. It wasn't an issue in those days. Now, if we are going to Yeshayahu Leibovich's words, this is the issue in the Orthodox world, and we need to deal with that. It's true that the majority are not interesting. This is the truth. But we, the rabbis, teachers, we need to put it in a central idea or thoughts or dilemma or argument in our areas to, first of all, to teach. I have the privilege to learn with the Rav Gilad daughter in Bet Morasha. We have a special program
to teach her,
to learn with her, and we have a special program to women equal to the program of the men, and I'm talking about second and third degree. It's not a program of a first step stages. It's a program learning Gemara with a very, very high standard, and we just want to declare that we need to give chance to women to find themselves in a position, in a leadership, in our world. Now, what will be the solution in the end between I'm living in Katamon, and Katamon, and we have the main road, Emek Refaim. So in one side we have Hasidut Erloi, quite Chatam Sofer style, and the other side we have Shira Hadasha. And we need to move ourselves, we need to move ourselves between Erloi and Shira Hadasha, but the message is that the women in our community, if they want, they need to find the stand and to be part of the leadership of the Kehila.
I actually want to pick up on something that both of you said, and I'm going to address this to Dr. Ross directly, and it's sort of the devil's advocate position, and what you said I've heard many times, actually, articulated by many people, both people who are sympathetic to feminist concerns and not sympathetic, and it sort of goes like this. You know, first of all, I don't see that a lot of women in the community are all that exercised by this issue. You know, why are you exercised by this issue? And given the massive rate of assimilation and the defection from Judaism in the modern world, and the Holocaust is behind us, and there's an existential threat to Israel in front of us, isn't feminism a kind of boutique issue, a kind of marginal concern? And it's not even pressed forward by the majority of Orthodox women, let alone men. That would be the devil's advocate argument. I've heard this argument many times, that most men and women are worried about more immediate problems, relationships, marriage, children, work, raising their children Jewishly, making sure they're shomrei mitzvot, etc. So given how difficult it is to sustain faith commitments in modernity anyway, doesn't pressing this issue kind of just open up a Pandora's box and allows for a barrage of, you know, rather crude Judaism as sexist kind of complaints that further undermine the ability of contemporary Jews to maintain fidelity to halakha? How would you respond to that critique, some of which was alluded to by the rabbis here?
Okay, first of all, I want to directly respond to Rabbi Gilad and say that every single article or even the book that I wrote regarding this issue was not my initiative. It was a response to people asking for this. So that there is certainly a group of people, and many of them are my students, who actually are begging for some sort of way of approaching the issues that are bound up with feminism. Regarding your question, Elliot, as you phrased it now, I take exception to the phrasing, pressing the feminist agenda. Jofa, Kolech, and the other women's interest groups have arisen because they face a real problem. Some aspects of that problem are more acute and pressing on a practical level than others. But one of the insights of feminism is that all of these questions are intertwined. Therefore, it would be very unfair and misleading to suggest, as some opponents of feminism do, that any of these issues are an artificial fabrication invented by the upper middle class women who have nothing better to do with their time. The second point to be made is that feminism isn't just about resolving questions of women's social and legal status in the practical world. It's also about suggesting that there are unique women's ways of viewing things that are capable of enriching the old and established views. Adding a feminist perspective to any of the other problems that you've mentioned, such as finding a marital partner, raising children Jewishly, making sure they remain true to Torah, finding a synagogue that fits, may actually offer new and more effective ways of dealing with these issues and resolving them. I think it's also very short-sighted to think that we can afford to ignore the challenges that feminism raises for halachic Judaism. In the long run, fidelity to halacha can't be maintained by placing a lock on our Pandora's box and hoping that the lid won't explode in our face. Such an attitude has traditionally been described as katnut ha'emunah, or a faltering of faith, and certainly doesn't invoke confidence in the resilience of Jewish tradition.
So I get here the distinct pleasure of getting to agree with Tamar. I do not think that feminism is a boutique issue. I, for one, do not have a commitment to feminism as a movement, particularly. Judaism has enough orthodoxies that are difficult to negotiate that I don't need to import a whole set of feminist orthodoxies to negotiate. But what I do have a commitment to is the particular students that I teach and my wife and my daughters and the community in which I live and the women with whom I end up, sympathetic men of whom I am one, with whom I have to engage. And in my classroom, I teach the introductory Gemara class to women with no Gemara background at all. And the issue is not Gemara. I think, thank God, the question of whether women are capable and entitled to learn Gemara is, at least in many, many camps, already passé. It's already been decided, and it's unproblematic. But if I cannot engage these women as intelligent, serious, dedicated people who deserve to be treated as mature and serious people, then I am lost. And they are certainly lost to Torah, and Torah is weakened. So my commitment, in other words, it's not a boutique issue. It's there because we're dealing with actual people who are struggling with this. Then I get to kind of move on, and the four of us here are all from Israel, so we're certainly familiar with this pattern. I imagine it exists here, but we're more politicized in Israel. It's the politician who gets on the radio and gets asked, you know, questions about envelopes full of cash that he's been given and says, that's not the real question. The real question is something else entirely. So I get to do that. It seems to me that the real question is not feminism as a boutique issue because there are other threats that we need to pay attention to. It seems to me that the devil's advocate position that we need to take seriously is aspects of the Haredi critique of feminism. I spoke a little bit about this from a very different perspective this morning in terms of images of family and et cetera, but I do think, and I have no answers to this whatsoever, that Orthodox Judaism has an enormous amount invested in what is perceived to be a fairly traditional nuclear family. And I even think that Judaism, Orthodox Judaism under contemporary conditions, has a great deal invested in at least some aspects of fairly traditional gender roles. Which means, I think, that to the extent that there's a devil's advocate position, it has to come from an appreciation of some aspects of the critique from the right, and I'm trying to speak carefully so I don't give off an impression of being somewhere where I'm not, further to the right, if you will, than I am. But I think we ought to take the questions that some of the more articulate Haredi criticisms of modern Orthodox feminism. Some of them, we have to filter out all the disingenuousness, as much of it as we can, filter out the power politics, filter out, etc. And I think we have to take seriously questions of traditional gender roles, or what are perceived as traditional gender roles, in nuclear families. I'm not sure that we yet have a model of how Orthodoxy is going to work without that. And it seems to me that pushing the feminism envelope too far is going to create all kinds of tensions. I can't articulate it better than that. I should be able to.
Can you articulate sort of candidly what some of the aspects, what some of those questions would be from the right? In plain language.
Yeah, plain language says that, to the extent that I understand it, there are voices within feminism that are concerned about this as well, says you can't have it all. Women are not capable of being, or many, many women are not capable of being also extremely dedicated to their children as mothers, to their families as husbands, and also successful career women to the extent that they can. Some are capable. Sometimes it creates tension. Again, I want to be very cautious in what I'm saying. I'm saying that that in some cases that raises questions that need to be thought about, and it creates tensions, and the tensions have not been solved because we have good reason to be dedicated both to the idea of women as mothers in full time and the idea of women as out there and involved. It's hard to say because I don't even agree with everything that I'm saying.
It doesn't matter. You're just rehearsing that view, and I want you to rehearse it. If you've raised it, rehearse it fully.
It would be nice to be able to say, I think of myself as an involved father, that let's move some of the paternal responsibilities to fathers, and let's shift the power relationships within the nuclear family, and that's a good idea. How far do you push it in your family, in questions of communal policy, in questions of educational policy? What are the long-term consequences of those shifts likely to be or not be? Are there ways that we can do it in more egalitarian and fair ways? What price are we going to pay? What unintended consequences are there going to be?
So you're saying that one really primary central concern is that the shift of the sort of identity of the Jewish woman away from the traditional notion of wife and mother and homemaker into...
I don't think it's actually traditional. I don't think it's what happened in the Middle Ages.
Okay,
but
so
I think
the contemporary notion. So there's a fear that shift in identity would threaten or undermine the stability of the modern Jewish family unit. Saying that's
formulate. I'd say use slightly different words, but yes.
Okay.
You can answer it.
First of all, you're not really disagreeing with me, but I was on a panel a few years ago in which there was a discussion about feminism and the threat to the traditional family, and most of the Orthodox people there felt it was a threat, and who knows what would happen. And then got up an unusual Reform rabbi in Israel, unusual because he was Israeli-born and he was Moroccan, and he said, "You're talking about the traditional family. I don't know what you're talking about. I used to go with my father to visit his mother, in other words, my grandmother, and she had been married to an old man, a rabbi, and he died, and they had a polygamous marriage. There was an older wife, and she used to throw up her hands and say, 'Kadosh Baruch Hu, why did you leave him? Why did you take him and leave me with this old hag that I have to take care of?'" So he said, "There's no such thing as a traditional Jewish family. It has evolved over time. Can we say that the family today that we idealize is like the family, as you say, in medieval times? Or can we talk about the pattern that we see in Bereshit, our forefathers? Is that the traditional Jewish family?" In other words, there is a concept of flux and change. And I think one of the contributions of the new freedom that women are taking on for themselves is to allow a certain amount of nisayon uti'iya, what do you say, trial and error. And I think so far, at least, those women who have appropriated new roles for themselves in the religious realm, certainly, I can only talk anecdotally of the people that I know, and I know quite a few of them. I think that they have model families in which, first of all, they are not afraid of producing several children, and their husbands are supportive, and they have good relations. But there is a definite shift in notions of child rearing, and also in notions of the importance of the woman's sense of her own spirituality and having her own time to learn, to daven, and to feel herself as a religious person independently of working vicariously through her husband. By all means, I think there should be respect for traditional gender roles, and there is a lot to be learned from the Haredi community. I don't think that it should all be pictured as a caricature of women who are oppressed. Many women find their religious fulfillment in the traditional roles, but I think that there is importance in allowing for more plurality. And as one of the radical feminists in the general feminist movement, Catherine MacKinnon, has said, first get your legs off our necks, and then we will see what the voice of women is. In other words, not to try and preconceive and pre-guess where women should be and where men should be, but to allow for a certain amount of freedom. And I think that within that freedom, especially when it is informed by Jewish tradition, there will be a certain measure of gender differentiation, sometimes more, sometimes less, but I don't think it's to the despair of the future of the Jewish family.
I want to see if we can get more specific here in terms of what we're talking about feminist concerns. And I want to ask Rav Gilad, you talked about trying to inspire some of this in your community. What do you think should be the central goals of a feminist contribution, and what are we even talking about when we're using this word? Are we talking about something pragmatic, you know, practical, i.e., pressing for certain kinds of halachic changes, whether they be women's aliyot, whether we even go further into straight egalitarian communities, whether we're talking about agunot, the development of poskot, or is it something more educational, such as sensitizing the populace to potential areas of sensitivity to women within the tradition? Should we be rewriting prayer language? Should we be deconstructing the biblical text? Right? There's when one uses a single word, and it can encompass a whole range of things. So I wanted to ask each of you, what does this mean to you when we're using this word, and what kind of changes would you be looking for?
Okay. First of all, I would like to just say two comments about the last question. I think that something that characterizes Yahadut, the Jewish tradition, all over the generations, we are not dealing just with things that are current issues, and we don't deal just with urgent issues, but we deal with what it is really important. And we deal, when we're learning Torah, and we're dealing with Shor Shenagach Et HaPara, or more than that, we're dealing with Kodshim and Taharot and Arachin and Kinim. So I think it's very, if we believe that this issue is important, we cannot just say this is a boutique issue or whatever. We have to deal with it because it is important, even though it's not maybe the issues that people are shouting and whatever, crying because of it. Secondly, I think that, as I've said, I think it's a way how to bring people to understand and to deal with issues of more sensitivity in general. And therefore, in my eyes, it's a window that through this issue we can promote other things that is very, very important in the Jewish life nowadays. And therefore, I disagree with this. I really think it's very, very important to deal with it. Regarding to your question, or to this last question, I really believe that there are many directions. The first one, obviously, I think we cannot disagree about it. The first thing is the question of gunot, of questions that people are suffering, pshuto kemashmo, without any other word. This is something that we cannot postpone. We have to deal with it right now, in this minute. I think there's no any disagreement about it. This is something that it's not just because of feminism, just because people are suffering from in the pshat of this meaning. But when I try to look about the contribution of the movement of feminism in Yadut, in general, I think that the Limud Torah is the most important thing in developing poskot. But I must tell you that I worry that the new wave of Talmidot Chachamim will be too much similar to the men. You know what I mean? You know that any community over the world, I think it's true about the history of United States and about Israel as well, every wave of newcomers brought something with them. To the culture, to science, to language, to many aspects of life. So now we have newcomers lomdot Torah in Jewish in the Jewish world, and I'm afraid that because they have to prove themselves, they have to be everything just like the men, and they will not be free enough to bring their own ideas and their own sensitivities, etc., to the discourse, to the halachic discourse, and this. This is my what my worried me. Just I tried to think when I was this morning or this night in the airplane to think about an example, something that can maybe revive or bring something new to our Jewish life. So I came to I'm not sure it's the best example, but I thought about tefillah. Okay, there is a machloket. What is the meaning of tefillot that nashim mechuyavot? Let's say that nashim will take upon themselves litpalel to daven three times a day. Why it should be exactly the same tefillah of the men? I feel, as a man, that sometimes I want to choose other prakim for psukei de zimra. It depends on my mood. One day I feel that the sky is bright and everything is nice and the world is smiling and I want to say this kind of prakei tehillim. And the other day, when I'm coming with a different mood, I feel bad, whatever, I will maybe say something else. So, just an example. So, if someone is now just starting to daven, why not to think that, let's see, maybe there are other options of opening this kind of tefillah. Obviously, we have to check everything halachically, if it's okay halachically, and I think this is not the problem. The problem is just that we stuck to the way that we used to be all generations, and when Nashim will start to daven, they will do it in the same way that Gvarim, that men. Why?
Okay.
My first experience in this issue was 20 years ago when I served in Kibbutz Sad, just started to be a rabbi there, and I had a neighbor called now is Dr. Gili Zivan. She one of the I think stronger feminism feminists in Israel, and she wrote an article 20 years ago, maybe 18 years ago, and she wrote an article about her feeling in Ezrat Nashim in the synagogue. And you should know that in Kibbutz Sad, when we used to live, it was a very open mechitza. But still, it was Ezrat Nashim. And her article was from her heart. She screamed that she felt like in a other place. She is not part of the tefillah. And the reaction that she got from rabbis in the kibbutz, not Rav Gilad, other kibbutzim, send letters to this review, and sent. I can remember the title, Haketza Akata. Why she scream? What's wrong with the mechitza? And it was with the cynic, with the sarcasm. All the reaction was so terrible, and for me it was the first lesson. To be in a position that even if you're not in her place, try to listen. She says something to you. Now we are, after 20 years, we are in many, many other different issues, and I found myself every time, every year, in a different issue, new issue, in this business of feminism. The last issue, I think that Professor Tamar was with me in an event, that a doctor came to say about the Shiva Nekiyim, that we are raised a problem in the halachic world that shouldn't be with the, you know, with the problem of a woman that cannot bring a child because these 7 days, and his solution is to cancel it. And Vatam Kolair, it's a really big machloket. But to listen and to understand that it is a problem, that we need to listen to understand that the voice of not just women, but a human being that feel different, feel the other, feel not in the camp, not inside the main road. This is something that it must put us in a different position and situation, and I don't want to give now directions, or I have many thoughts about Limud Torah. I agree with Rav Gilad that the new Limud Torah of women will bring renaissance to the men Limud Torah. Absolutely. The music of Limud Torah will change. The Brisk language will find themselves in a different... I feel in Israel now with the voice of the mobile. But you know,
I
what
ask
the,
everyone to turn
you,
off
you know
cell
what the difference is. In Israel, you will answer. I want to say that we as men, never mind if we're rabbis, teachers, we need to have respect to listen to our colleagues, to the half part of the world that want to found themselves in the world as the partners. And with bit anava of our side, the world would be much better.
I'll try and repeat the question again. What do you think should be the central goals of a feminist contribution to contemporary Judaism? Should they be pragmatic, or should they be something more up in the air, sensitizing the population? Rav Gilad tried to distinguish and say that we really should deal with the pressing questions, and of course everybody agrees with that. But I want to contend that if there's one thing that feminism has taught us, it is that all questions are interrelated. And even though it is of prime importance to deal with the practical ones, it is impossible to neglect the surrounding factors, because they all impact on each other. So nothing should be mutually exclusive. In terms of what the feminist revolution can contribute to Jewish life, Rav Gilad again expressed the chashash, the suspicion or worry that women in their, he was all approving of the learning revolution, but that women may get stuck in being too like men. I think what is happening in the Jewish world is simply repeating, and it always is so in every particular discipline or area, the development that has informed feminism at large, that first feminists feel that in order to improve their position, they have to have an equal share in the men's pie, which means exactly mimicking the men. And so the Batei Midrash also, the epitome of success is when a woman can go like this and have the same body language and the same ideals of learning as the men. But I think Rav Gilad's worry is already being dispelled, because I think as the women's learning movement has grown, there definitely is developing also a woman's way of learning, which is different than that of the men, which is based partly on a critique and partly developing new women's ways of approaching texts. And as Rav Lau has suggested, that this also is impacting on men's yeshivot. I don't know if directly or because it's in the air and everybody wants it. I know I've had the experience in teaching in Midrashat Lindenbaum that very often a few girls will bring up tape recorders and put them in front and say, this is a friend of mine in the yeshiva, in men's yeshiva, sort of jealous of what we're doing here. Do you mind if I tape? And so I have several silent members participating in the class who are men. And I do believe that what is happening in the women's end is affecting not only ways of learning, but also there are different ways as... I think Rav Gilad suggested that he would like a more personalized kind of tefillah, and certainly there are the women's tefillah groups and their impact on synagogue services at large is, in a sense, to try and mitigate hierarchies, mitigate the culture of kibudim, of terrible emphasis on who gets honors first and second. In women's tefillah groups, women tend to prefer to sit in a circle rather than in rows. And also in halachic discourse, just as in the legal profession at large, people who have noted the feminist impact on legal theory have noted that women are much more interested in conciliatory or dialogic methods of resolving problems rather than adversarial methods. There is an interest in developing law that is more related to or more sensitive to consequences of jurisdiction rather than obedience to formal rules, and in general a willingness to have extra halachic or extra legal principles impact on the judicial process. And I think that as women enter more and more into the area of halachic interpretation, that will impact also, or it already is, on a certain style of halakha, which, very interestingly, some people, scholars, believe that that is a characteristic of legal practice in Chazal's times, and some people have tried to draw comparisons between the classical Jewish understanding of how one does law and feminist current legal jurisprudence.
Taking up from that, since the real core issue in some ways for many lay people is how far can you stretch, right, traditional conceptions of Judaism and Jewish law before you say maybe this isn't Judaism anymore, right? I was first struck by this when I read a book by Judith Plaskow called Standing Again at Sinai. She's a non-Orthodox feminist. And admittedly, I was reading it as an Orthodox man. But at a certain point, I felt as I was reading the book, well, if you take away this, and you take away this, and you take away this, and you take away this, so because you see all of these things as somehow patriarchal or sexist or non-inclusive, so aren't really saying in a way that there's no meat left on the bones anymore, and you might as well start again with a brand new religion. Now, the part that's confusing for me is, or that I'd like clarified, is in light of feminist claims, how much can we change something before we have a brand new entity altogether? Or to make the question sharper, what's the line? Is there a line between halachic evolution or halachic revolution, whatever you want to say, and at some point, Judaism as it was historically constituted now begins to disintegrate, right? And how do we prevent halakha now from people just sort of lining up and expressing their concerns? Because if we start saying, well, things are historicized, so people can come and talk about permissibility of homosexual relationships, permissibility of lots of things. And I'm not taking a stand on these either way. I'm saying, theoretically, it would be a very, very long line now of people saying, well, let's change it. So what I'm trying to grasp here is how do we bring forward something and still maintain the animal that we call Judaism? Anybody can take that. You want to start with y'all? I'll start with y'all.
So once again, I want to reiterate finding myself on the right-hand side of the panel, both physically and, I guess, religiously here, is to reiterate part of my own critique of Professor Ross, is to say that what she has provided is a meta-halakha, but not a halakha. And what her book manages to do is to take a bird's-eye view and say, well, over the course of history, over the course of thousands of years, over the course of hundreds of years, over the course of generations, anything is possible. And it is difficult from an historical perspective to deny that. And what she has not done, and which I would very much like to see done, is to bring that in conversation with psak on the ground. Meaning, what did Rav Moshe think he was doing when he wrote a tshuva? Now, he's given us an articulation in the Hakdama to Igrot Moshe, which very interestingly I think has some parallels to what you said, that the authority is invested in the Posek as the Posek, and authority is not invested in God's original absolute intent, and there's a measure of relativism and even a measure of historical awareness and awareness of subjectivity. But when he was sitting and writing a tshuva, sometimes about issues of tremendous social and political concern, and sometimes about issues that from a sociological perspective are dvarim shel ma bekach, things that are not apparently of great social concern. He thought he was doing something, and he didn't give us a detailed articulation of that, and for the most part, Poskim did not. And there's an enormous amount of work to go into trying to figure out what is this enterprise of psak, not from starting from legal theory and feminist theory and theory of language, but starting from the actual text of Tshuvot, and say, what did they think they were doing with the Gemara? What did they think they were doing with the Rishonim? How did they determine what was authoritative and not authoritative? And I think that is a critical piece of the conversation that has not yet been written and ought to be brought into conversation with some of the meta halacha that is being done both by feminists and people whose concerns of meta halacha are slightly different. I want to bring a couple of concrete examples that I think have to do with real borders. I don't know what will be in several generations, but I do know that I personally, I can't speak for anyone beyond myself and for my family, am not prepared at the moment to take things that are written from an Orthodox feminist perspective that are clearly not the same animal as traditional psak. And if you have women who are writing Orthodox or self-proclaimed Orthodox positions that say, we ought to change matbea shekavu chachamim, the language of the brachot, shelo asani isha, based on Italian manuscript that we know to be a scribal error, but we ought to base our contemporary psak on that as well, despite enormous discomfort and question marks with the language of the bracha, shelo asani isha, that is not Orthodox psak. That is something else. And as I mentioned last night,
What about just giving this bracha?
So I'm not a posek, and I don't know.
Well,
the
what do you think?
I understand somebody who doesn't do it. I understand somebody who doesn't do it. But I would not make that the text of Tfilah in my Bet Knesset.
Why?
Again, I'm not a posek.
No, I'm not. I'm asking because you. I'm not asking posek.
Because the principle of doing something that is clearly not Orthodox halacha and making that policy is a decision that fundamentally undermines the system, and the system demands integrity at the moment, whatever is going to be in several generations. And I'll take it a step further, and I say this not as a critique of recent women's writings about halakha, much of it, relatively speaking, traditional, and much of it very traditional. I would like to see the day, and it hasn't come yet, and the ground is not there yet, when questions of women's halakha written by women are embedded within the other questions of dvarim shel ma bekach. It is more difficult to take, not take seriously, it is more difficult to take as a matter of practice a halachic position maintained by a woman whose only halachic expertise is in women's issues, than one that is embedded within a concern for many other issues. Again, to take the example of Rav Moshe Feinstein, he was able to write some very radical tshuvot. He was able to write the category of Chalav Akum out of existence for decades within American Judaism because it was embedded within volumes and volumes of extremely traditional, extremely standard issue psak. The ground is not there yet to do it, but at the moment, I think what we need is a serious engagement with tshuvot, with the nitty-gritty of halakha, and we need to expand the horizons of women's learning and women's voices to include not only questions that are perceived as being feminist questions, but questions that are perceived as just being another siman in Shulchan Aruch.
Okay.
Yeah. In terms of determining what is orthodox halakha or not halakha, or when is it justified to rely on some weirdo minority opinion in an Italian manuscript, I don't think that feminists, or those sympathetic with feminist issues, are the only ones to do so. I collect countless examples of issues in which very often you think the halakha would be working in one direction, and voila, it opens out in another direction. For example, the notion that after 10 years, a childless couple have to divorce because the husband has to procreate. Or, for example, the issue which is very firmly grounded in Hilchot Talmud Torah of the Rambam and also in the Gemara, that bachelors should not be teaching Tinokot Shel Bet Rabban. Or even the issue of Talmud Torah when it first began. Somebody begins the change. I remember I was in the beginning when Midrashat Lindenbaum started, and the whole idea of a woman holding a Gemara was such a bizarre, and it evoked such visceral reactions against it. But somebody began with, even though the dominant tradition for generations had been against or discouraging women from learning Torah, and now this has become normative. So I think there is no objective criterion of when is one allowed to go on out on a limb and when not. And it is very difficult. I believe that we should develop criteria of deciding when to do so and when not to do so. But I don't think the criteria are strictly formal. They have to do with a lot of subjective assessment and discretion, discretionary judgment. Is this going out on a limb done out of purity of motivation? Is this going out on a limb going to actually benefit Klal Yisrael and the future of Torah Judaism or not? Is this going out on a limb halachically practical? Is there communal readiness for this kind of thing? What is the value behind it? There are all sorts of questions that need to be asked, which in the past were usually intuited by the posek without his giving a din v'cheshbon, but sometimes even then not done unconsciously, but sometimes consciously. And our difficulty now is that we are very aware of what we are doing, and this consciousness sometimes cripples us from moving further. And I think one of the very important items on the feminist agenda, not only on the part of women, but also on the part of poskim who are sympathetic to women's concerns, is developing some sort of scale of values that will serve as a measure of articulating the scale of values, whether a certain proposition is halachically desirable or not desirable. Regarding the second comment, that it would be much healthier and more respectable if women who were involved in halachic issues would not only address the woman's question and things that are of sectarian interest to women, absolutely, I think that will come. But the natural progression is first women are concerned with issues that they feel deeply, and once they have established their place in these kind of issues and the atmosphere is more relaxed and women are accepted into the interpretive process altogether, then definitely their impact I don't think it will happen in one generation. I think that there's a snowball effect that has to take place in terms of women's expertise, and today we don't have the women who are on that level of learning, but if the snowball progresses and women continue to express interest in halakhic literacy and in immersing themselves in the sources, that eventually that very sectarian interest will expand and produce a woman's contribution to the way that we approach halakha at large.
Did you relate to the question, is there any red line?
You're asking me?
Yes.
I'm sure there is a red line. In every generation, that red line
is determined
by what in that particular generation is regarded as a red line, but red lines the move. In Danny Sperber's latest book on development of halakha, he cites an example of a riverbed that has a current flowing through it. And one of his protagonists said, why are you going out on a limb regarding Shira Hadasha type of minyanim? You have to flow with the halachic current. So he says, yes, if I take this example further, there is a current, but we know with riverbeds that sometimes in the course of time, the current changes in a particular direction, and suddenly we see that the river is flowing in the opposite direction or even creating a delta and several streams occur. And that's what happens in halakha as well. You think things are going in a particular way, and then certain events, sometimes external and sometimes internal, force halakha to take a new and totally unexpected direction, and then that becomes a new red line.
Okay, I just like to add a few comments. First of all, sometimes I feel that people are dealing so much with meta halakha until we come to the conclusion that the halakha meta, from meta halakha, and there's no halakha anymore. And I'll take a minor example that you mentioned regarding Shelas and Isha, but afterwards I would like to relate to the main issue. Shelas Anisha is a good example that I think it's not such a big issue. Because if, I'll tell you, I say every morning Shelas Anisha, but I know that if there is someone in my Kehillah, that the fact that I'm saying Shelas Anisha, let's say the Chazan saying Shelas Anisha, she is offended by it, I think that halachically, okay, I will not say it now as a psak, but I think we have to consider it very seriously. I think there is a ground halachically not to say it. Just because to offend someone is much, much more severe. It's a question of kvod abriyot. Then this bracha, it is berkat ha-shevach. If, just for example, there is berkat meshane abriyot. If you see someone that is ba'almum, certain ba'almum, you have to say meshane abriyot. Do you think that there is halacha that we have to say meshane abriyot in front of him if it will offend him? Obviously, no. Why? Because obviously we have to measure things davar neged davar. And the form, I had this discussion with my daughter a few years ago. It bothered her that I am saying this bracha. And it was the time that I almost convinced to stop saying it. But afterwards I said to myself, you know, כל כך הרבה דברים אני לא מכוון, גם בזה אני לא מכוון. זה לא נורא. Therefore, I'm still saying Shelas Anisha. The main issue, I believe that the idea of cumulative revelation, I think it's a great idea. I agree with it. I think that basically Rav Kook spoke about it, but I think we have to use in a very, very careful way a kind of I will call it intellectual dignity. What do they mean? When you use the dogma, the example of the relations to homosexuality, our approach to homosexuality, I think this is a good example that I can say, I can show what is the difference between women's issue and this issue. Why? Because when I'm dealing with trying to promote, to change to a woman's status in halakha, I believe that this is the direction of the Torah, because I listen to Perek Aleph in Bereshit and I see what does it mean that men and women were created in image of God, and I see Vedavak Beishto, and obviously, just when I ask myself, Cherem Rabbeinu Gershom, when he says that you are allowed to take just one woman, one wife, and not more than that, it's basically, you can see from Perek Aleph and Perek Bet Bereshit, Al Ken Yazor Vishet Aviv Edmo Vedavak Beishto Ve'ula Basar Echad, that basically this is the ideal situation. So you can understand how when Rabbeinu Gershom came with this idea, this was what I call the arrow theory. You have to define what is the arrow, what is the direction of the Torah, of the halacha, of the mainstream of Torah and halacha, and you can develop halacha according to this direction. But when you come to homosexuality, when the Torah call it to'eva, it's much more difficult to come and to say, you know, you cannot say that by trying to, I'm very aware and we have to be very sensitive to the metzuka, to the pain, and it's very, you have to do it in a very, very sensitive way. But still, to be honest and to use this kind of intellectual dignity, I cannot say that this is the direction of halacha, when the direction of the Torah, when the Torah call it to'eva. Just to, so I'm not coming into this specific issue, just as an example that I think we have to try, and I know that there are no, and I agree that there is no very clear cut red line or very bemet, something that you can say those are the lines that I have to follow. But I think we can identify what is the direction, and we have to work in a very, very sensitive way within the framework of halacha to do things that, as you have said, we still can say honestly afterwards, this is basically halacha, this is basically yadut. And of course, this is a difference between changing the matbea of bracha. This is just an example that can say, how can I develop, how can I push my direction without breaking the hagdarot, the definitions of halacha. I will not change the bracha, I just will not say it. And I think there is a basically halachic justification for this kind of approach.
I'm just a little curious. I'm going to get to you in one moment. There's something that, maybe I heard you incorrectly, but there seems something self-contradictory here. On the one hand, you sort of joked about meta halacha, but it seems to me that's exactly what you just did. In other words, you tried to locate values within the tradition. You tried to ascribe values to the tradition. And then you're trying to sort of direct the halakha towards those values, if that's the case. So we now are left with the very messy business of discerning which statements in the Torah are the ones that should direct the flow of halachic process. For instance, in Bereshit Perek Gimel, Tetvav Tet Zion, it says that he's going to rule over you. Should I look at that statement that's said in Gan Eden and see it as a description or a prescription or something that should sort of dominate the halachic process? So one could say no. Should I say that about Toeva? Should I say that about dozens of other statements? Because now we're all locked into the kinds of issues that actually, frankly, Dr. Ross raises in her book about statements that historically, you know, were said at one time that maybe are not a prescriptive value for later generations, and now we're going into the business of deciding which ones still stand as prescriptions for later generations, which ones fall off as prescriptions. So I'm a little bit, you know, it's funny because emotionally, I like what you're saying, but intellectually it makes me very uneasy because now one has to now locate, well, which of the things that I think should be the directors for that process. I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
I think it's very difficult to define right now, but I really believe that there is a way to define in general the general picture. But just for example, when we have Ve'alachta Bidrachav, sorry?
What you define?
When we have Ve'alachta Bidrachav, mitzvah chet, that the Rambam says as mitzvah chet b'sefer ha-mitzvot, ma'u rachum v'fata rachum, things that are things that we have to go and
to
try to imitate,
to walk in God's way.
Well, to walk in God's way in a way that it is moral, that it is sensitive to the other, to the weak parts of the society. These kinds, like Doshim Tiyu, like Ve'asita Yashar V'Tov, these kinds of general mitzvot that you can understand, you have to be
holy,
you have to be holy, yeah, and to go in the way of justice and righteousness. This kind of approach, I think you can know, you can prove that this is the mainstream, the main direction of halacha. and if you take the pasuk boim shel bach, so you can say bezeat apecha tochal lechem, maybe it's you have to sweat when you are eating bread. Basically, it's no one will say that there is isur lechol lechem bli zeah, because it's written bezeat apecha tochal lechem. The world is going to release himself from this curse, and the same way from boim shel bach, we have to release ourselves from this klala.
In today's context, you read it that way, but there were generations that read this as a permanent klala. So in other words, the values that you regard as bottom line are very dependent on context. Mm-hmm. And one never can know. One has to relate to what we see now as absolute. But in the background, know that there is a possibility that in a future generation or under different circumstances, the lines will be shifted.
Even if the Torah defines something as a toeva, you can say that we...
Oh, okay, you want me to say something about that?
We just have 1 minute, but you get the last minute.
Okay. Several years ago, Talmidah was very close to me and came from the secular world. She said, Tamara, if you're getting into feminism, you're not going to be able to avoid homosexuality. And I didn't appreciate it then, but I certainly found subsequently that she was correct. And I do believe that the ban, although the ban on homosexuality in Jewish tradition is far more explicit, unequivocal, and deep-seated than the encouragement of role stratification between the sexes, and at least in the case of male homosexuality, stems clearly from the Torah, rather than from subsequent halachic development. There is also a family resemblance, at the very least, between the issue of feminism and of homosexuality, and the same interpretive strategies that allow for the breakdown of traditional conceptions of male-female roles can, in principle, be applied to the legitimacy of homosexuality. These strategies are already being adopted by some today. They are not in Orthodox circles. There are lesbians and homosexuals, for example, who understand the Torah's talk of abomination, toiva, as referring specifically to the physical act of penetration or to fly-by-night relationships rather than to the long-term commitments that some seek today in the form of homosexual unions. Despite the important disparities between the discourse on homosexuality and on feminism, I see no intrinsic difference in principle between these arguments and similar interpretive strategies that are employed to accommodate new roles for men and women or to adapt to other changing societal circumstances and moral intuitions. The same can be said for our changed attitude to the issue of Ben Sorel Umore, genocide, doctors attending to non-Jews, Jewish lives on Shabbat, the requirements stuff that I've mentioned before, childless couples and the like. Whether such readings will ever lead to viewing homosexuality as a halachically legitimate option rather than a problematic aberration, or even as a potential contribution to the enrichment of human experience, is debatable, but I have no doubt that the resolution of this question will have far less to do with firm distinctions between the meat and the bones of Jewish theory, of Judaism, than with contemporary assessments of the moral, religious, anthropological, and cultural cost-benefit calculations involved, and the degree of confidence of the mainstream community that it can absorb the peripheral groups' interests without causing undue damage to its perceived integrity and stability. In other words, now, perhaps in our circles, it appears inconceivable, but very much has to do with what is going to happen in the surrounding culture and also how homosexuality will be perceived within the Jewish community and what are the cost-benefit.
What about Avodah Zarah? I have an idea. Avodah Zarah as well. We can say, what about Gilui Arayot?
Avodah Zarah, Gilui
Arayot.
Can I go further? Yeah. I think there's a hidden assumption in your claim. And that is your religious naturalism. You can do away with the simple and obvious reading of the pasuk because in the end of the day your notion of revelation is naturalistic and you don't believe that a metaphysical God has come into the world and communicated. And so it's really a natural text. It's not a supernatural text.
No, I don't accept that. I do promote a vision of revelation that is supernatural and natural at one and the same time. This is something that I can't get into.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just want to say that the most interesting part of the book is actually on this question, the question of what religious language means and how do the metaphysics of revelation actually work. But I'm afraid that we've got all of this now on regular chat. Say Ulmad, we have to stop right there. Please give them a big hand.